Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and thanks for joining us. And thanks to Ollie and Callum for From the Pavilion. And welcome to Flavour with Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman. And sadly, Alan Alder is away this weekend.
Today we hear food writer Felicity Cloak on her cycling tour of France in search of the perfect croissant and the best regional dishes.
Average day, you know, get out quite early because you want to get on the road quite early. And I used to try and do 30 kilometres before I stop for breakfast because that's quite nice to get that under your belt. And then you stop and you can have two croissants because you've just done that. And a little terrible coffee, very strong, usually bad, but very welcome.
We've some top tips from Cambridge's top chefs. Today it's potatoes.
Boil them, and then as soon as you drain them, put some vinegar on them. I'm really into white balsamic, white Italian vinegar at the moment, because it's got a tiny bit of sweetness.
We are also on the first of our wild food features from Steve Thompson of the Green Man Pub in Grantchester.
Right, this is going on our next menu. And we've just done a lovely muntjac dish with some ground elder pearl barley.
And South Cambridgeshire food blogger Laura Donoghue talks about her work as a food writer. And last week, the Oxford-Cambridge wine tasting competition took place, and Flavour was there to check it out.
It's interesting. It's interesting trying to tell a story where for an hour and a half everybody was dead silent.
Well, I know. And all you can hear is spitting.
A lot of swirling, a bit of groaning.
And of course, we have our usual features, the Twitter news and what free food is available in the Cambridge area right now on the Olio app.
So let's begin. And Sue interviewed The Guardian's Felicity Cloak on Flavour last year about her new book. Well, Felicity has another new book and it's just been published. Alan met with her last week and he sent us this piece just before he went off on his holiday. Not a cycling one, I think.
Ever thought of doing a six-week bike tour of France, tasting croissants and local dishes as you go? It's what food writer Felicity Cloak did last summer. Unfortunately, while we had it unusually hot, in France they had it unusually wet. I met Felicity in London's Granary Square last week and asked her all about it, starting with what a typical day was like.
I mean, it wasn't a typical day in that it varied so much depending on where I was, what the weather was doing. I was also there during summer of rail strikes, so although I did intend to take some trains, because France is a very big place, that wasn't always possible, so I ended up doing some cycling I didn't intend to do. But I would say, you know, average day, you know, get out quite early because you want to get on the road quite early. And I used to try and do sort of psychologically at least 30 kilometres before I stop for breakfast, because that's, you know, it's quite nice to get that under your belt. And then you stop and you can have two croissants because you've just done that, and a little terrible coffee, very strong, usually bad but very welcome, with sugar, and then carry on going. But thing about France that I knew but didn't really know until I did this is that lunch is really at midday strictly. You know, you can push it to 12:30 maybe, but if you're any later than that, nowhere is open or nowhere will serve you. You know, they've stopped serving and none of the bakeries are open either, so I really had to have a lunch plan. So that started to worry me. As soon as breakfast was over, I had to think, gosh, what am I going to eat for lunch? You know, it's just a nice thing, except sometimes you don't find anything for lunch. It's quite stressful. And then, yeah, I'd cycle. I'd try and find something, because I was looking at different recipes, so I'd try and find somewhere for lunch that was relevant to what I was looking at. So say if I was in the Alps, somewhere that did great tartiflette, or, you know, Normandy more marinière, do that. Maybe have a chat to the chef if I could find them. And, you know, they were obviously out the back having a cigarette by the end. And yeah, then carry on and find somewhere to stay. So it was all quite ad hoc. And I quite often ended up cycling until sort of 7, 8 in the evening just to get the kilometres under the belt.
It sounds like there were a lot of kilometres.
There were. I actually thought it would be more. So I think it was, I think I did about 2,300 odd kilometres. So I did take some trains. The biggest stretch I did sort of without help, I did Strasbourg on the German border right into Paris, which is very satisfying to do that stretch. I would have liked to have done it all under my own steam.
But what sort of distance on average day then?
Average was probably 80 kilometres probably. The most I did was 156 in the foothills of the Pyrenees, which was not my most enjoyable day in the saddle. No, no. And then sometimes, you know, I'd just do a handful sort of to and from a railway station and the campsite and things. So it did very much vary. But, you know, comfortably, if you're used to it and terrain isn't too difficult, you can very easily do sort of 120 without it seeming... You know, it's that, if you don't cycle, I think that sounds like a lot, but actually it's not right. That much.
So you must have been magnificently fit when you set off.
No, unfortunately not. I was fit by the time I finished. I mean, I cycle anyway around London, which is very different endeavour to cycling, you know, thousands of kilometres around France. But I was so busy before I left that I didn't really have the opportunity to sort of get into training. You know, I only bought my new bike. I think he only arrived maybe a week before I left. So I didn't even really have a chance to get out. And they, you know, the bike shop wanted to take him back after a month to do tinkering. I was like, I'm going to be in France in a month. This is, you know, it's not going to work. So no training was done.
Right. And you made things, I suppose, in some ways really rather difficult by having things like a tent and presumably
yes.
a sleeping bag.
So yes.
A lot of weight.
Well, I weighed it when I got back because I was interested. And I think it came to about 25 kilos, which actually... It's not that bad. It was a very small tent. It was christened the body bag, and it really does look like a black plastic body bag. There's no room to sit up in any part of it. And then a very small very lightweight sleeping bag. And that I didn't take a stove or anything, because in France, you know, we're not going into the desert or something.
Yeah.
It's France. You know, lovely as it is to cook in a campsite, I was there to eat sort of restaurant food and, you know, etc., sample local produce.
Why did you do it?
I've always liked cycling, and I've long had a love of France. We used to go there every single holiday, when I was growing up, we'd go camping somewhere in France. My mum was a French teacher, you know, we were sort of steeped in it. It was very, you know, the time when Peter Mayle was very big, and, you know, everything was France. France was exotic. And so I've always loved it, and I'd love cycling, and a friend of mine actually suggested that we cycled, a group of us, we cycled from Calais to Brussels a few years ago. Just gave me the bug for how fun it is just to be on two wheels. There's an incredible freedom in it. And walking, I love walking, but you can't cover so much ground walking. It's sort of I find cycling an incredibly sort of freeing, but also a very tranquil experience. You know, you see the landscape change around you, but it's slow enough that you notice that. And I just thought it would make a really great book. I thought, you know, we've neglected France for a while in this country. I think we've been tempted by, you know, the first was Italy, and then much more exotic sort of food certainly have entered our diet, and that's brilliant. But I do think that we've all still got a little bit of nostalgic love for France, and I wanted to rediscover it, and I thought maybe other people would like to come along for the ride.
Well, I suppose in Europe, Spain has sort of gone up in people's estimation as far as food is concerned, and France maybe has got the reputation of being possibly a bit staid. What did you find about French food? Did you find it was a bit staid or
I found, I mean, I knew that they were incredibly conservative. I can't speak for Spain or Italy, which I guess are the two comparisons, because I don't know them well enough. But I spent a lot of time in France, and my parents lived there for a while, so I feel like I've slightly got a handle on it, although I found that I didn't know it as well as I thought I did. So they're very conservative. I found the same dishes on restaurant menus around the country, you know, little roadside restaurants, nothing fancy, and you know, you get your sweetbreads and you get your fish in white sauce, and it's all very similar. And so I found that interesting, in that certainly I think your average British diet would probably be very surprised. I know this is not what everyone eats at home in France, but still I think we've got a much more adventurous palate than they have. You know, there was a woman, I was down in the south, and I ordered this wonderful dish of it's pasta and sort of meatballs and then sausage and a slightly spicy sort of pecan tomato sauce. And it's a speciality of Sète down on the Mediterranean coast, because a lot of Italian sailors and dockers sort of migrated to the south of France in the 19th century, so there's quite a bit of Italian influence there. Anyway, and so I ordered this, I've been recommended it as a local speciality, and I was about to tuck in. It had been a terrible day on the bike, it was very wet, even though I was on the south of France. And then the woman, I take my first mouthful, And the waitress rushed over, you know, really apologetic, and said, "Oh, madame, I forgot to tell you, it's very spicy, be careful." And so I nearly laughed in her face. It was so, it was no spicier than, you know, sweet and sour chicken or something. But, you know, in that, that chili is not a big part, you know, of their diet, even in the south. And I found myself craving things like chili sauce, etc. But in general, I found the food, I would say, and I'd be interested to repeat the experiment in the UK, but from my experience in the UK, I would say that French food, although certainly I'm sure not as good as it, it used to be, is much better than you can find without research in the UK. And you can get some wonderful food here now, but you have to really do your research beforehand. In France, you can get some mediocre food, it's easy, but you can, the standard generally was decent and it was home cooked. And yeah, it was quite samey, but it was about, you know, they valued the local ingredients, and there was an importance put on ingredients and cooking that I more rarely find in this country.
When I read the book, I mean, I was struck actually by the regionalism of it. Is that because when you were in a region, you wanted to try the foods of that region, even though there were things on sale that you could get anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, that's me anyway. I think as a food writer, I'm endlessly curious about food and greedy. And so I always order the regional speciality, even if I actually want something completely different. I think, oh no, I need to have this special thing so I can only get here. But certainly there are, you know, there are rules. And for example, when I was in Lorraine, I really wanted to have a quiche Lorraine because I wanted to sort of, I've been to Lorraine before, but I don't think I've ever thought about quiche Lorraine as a particularly regional dish. And when you think about it, it is, you know, it's got that kind of Germanic influence to it with the sort of the lardons, and it used to be made of bread dough as well. Anyway, and so I was there, and it must have been late June. Yeah, it was late June. And I couldn't find a quiche Lorraine anywhere. And eventually I asked some people in a bar, and they said, "Oh no, you won't find it. You won't find it in June. It's a winter dish." Can you imagine going to Bakewell in Derbyshire and being told you won't find a Bakewell tart here? See, that's the most famous thing, certainly in the UK, from Lorraine. And no quiche. I did find some in the end in a bakery, but they clearly thought I was very eccentric for ordering it. So yeah, it's not only regional but very seasonal as well.
One of the other things that struck me was, and I don't know whether this just reflects your sort of experimental outlook on things, but what I would call the sort of the extreme carnivorous nature of some of the dishes.
There's a
passage here. I mean, I wonder if you would mind reading that paragraph.
Okay. So this is in Lyon, in Bouchon in Lyon, which is sort of quite a rustic restaurant where they serve wine from the barrel. Really good fun type place, it's very casual. "The table fills with vast bowls of pressed pig snout, soft pink sausage, and the best tripe I've ever tasted, which, frankly, is a low bar. This particular bovine stomach clears with ease, given it tastes of neither bleach nor shit, allowing us to appreciate its intriguingly bouncy, frilly texture without any such unpleasant distractions. Plus some lentil vinaigrette as a token nod to fibre." And that was just the start. Afterwards, we had calf's head, we had some deep fried tripe, which is a Lyonnaise speciality, which oddly enough has the, it's called fireman's apron, and no one seems to know why, but it's sort of deep fried slabs of tripe, surprisingly delicious. And, you know, all sorts.
The andouillette.
Yeah, the andouillette was actually, again, the best andouillette that I've tasted. I don't know, you know, that I would seek it out again, but I like to try these things to check on myself.
Right, but there were gentler things too, weren't there?
Yes. I mean,
obviously croissants, which is
one
of the things you were studying, which you have given a score to.
I have,
What's your criteria for a good croissant?
I mean, it's very nerdy, and I only started doing it as a joke, and then I realised that some other people are as nerdy as I am, and they like to have things rated. And so what I look for, and this is very subjective, obviously, as all of these things are, but I like them to be very crisp on the ends, but not dry, just crisp, and slightly squidgy in the middle, which I think technically is probably incorrect. If you see a beautiful sort of perfectly laminated croissant cut through with a knife, which is barbarism, it all has very separate layers and it's very airy. I like it to be a little bit doughy in the middle, and to have a really buttery flavour, so you can really taste that French butter, and then to be sort of sweet and not too sweet, not too salty, not too bready, to, you know, but to have a really distinct flavour. I mean, it's as much about the texture as the flavour for me, but there's some terrible. I do, you know, I ate some really mediocre croissants in France.
And there's quite a few recipes in here as well. How did you devise the recipes? I mean, presumably they're not just sort of from a book off the shelf.
No. No.
You've done your own research, as you do with your Guardian column.
Yeah, so some of them actually are adapted from the Guardian column. So if you take something like Beef Bourguignon, I'd already done that for the column. But, you know, I may have cooked 6 or 7 different versions, but I hadn't been to Burgundy and eaten 3 in 2 days, which is what I did. By that time, it was very hot, so it wasn't ideal for eating Beef Bourguignon, but there we are, I'm a professional. And so I sort of, that informed. So what I found interesting, my favourite in Burgundy, which was one that I ate in Dijon, that they put a little bit of sweet spice in the sauce, I think it's cloves and star anise, and that sort of really brought out that sort of warming quality of the beef and the wine itself, and I thought I added an extra something, and they served it with garlic croûte on top, which really nice touch, again not necessary but just delicious. And so I sort of took stuff in that base, I took stuff, looked at my recipe, you know, looked at what I'd picked up there and sort of did a bit of tweaking. And in others I'd never done the recipes before, and so I sort of talked to people there. I came back, you know, I spent a lot of time in the British Library looking at sort of French cookery books, a lot of French cookery books, to try and find, you know, a little bit like I would have done the perfect column. So something like choucroute garni from Alsace, which is not something I would have done for the column, because you have to make your own choucroute, which takes sort of 3 weeks to ferment.
That's a fermented cabbage.
It's fermented cabbage. More people probably know in this country as sauerkraut, which is just the German name for it. But it's fermented properly rather than pickled in vinegar. So you make that yourself. And when I was in Alsace, I made my poor, long-suffering friend Gemma come to a choucroute factory on a guided tour. We were the only people on this guided tour. Some of the French was quite technical, and good for her. I did buy her a beer when we got to the campsite. But so that was a process of talking to Madame there, looking at cookbooks, and just putting that together into a recipe that I was happy with. So yeah, it was a process of trial and error, really.
I realised that you were embarked on this trip when I saw tweets. I saw tweets from you saying that you were about to enter some town or city, and did people have any advice on good croissants or anything else? Was that successful? Was that, that a good thing to do?
It was an incredible resource, and actually my phone, because it was so wet, my phone became quite temperamental down in the south of France, and I became worried. When I'm on a bike, I'm not looking at my phone, which is one of the nice things about it, but off the bike it's incredibly useful for all sorts of practical things. And one of them was getting restaurant recommendations, and it's amazing. I mean, social media gets a lot of flack, but one of the things it's great for is if you ask where's a good place to eat in Cagnes-sur-Mer, someone will know, someone will have some advice. And so I used that a lot, and I found it great. But what was sad was people would, for certain places, people would bombard me with recommendations, and I didn't have time to try them all.
Yes.
I wish I kept a little directory now, so if I go back, I can actually try them.
And were there any particularly low points or high points? You've mentioned the rain.
Yeah.
I take it that was a low point.
The low point, the very lowest point, actually, and there are a few. It wasn't unadulterated fun, I have to say. But probably the lowest point was my birthday, which was a couple of days before I finished, actually. And I was on my own for my birthday. My friend Gemma had just gone home, and I was meeting people in Paris. But for my birthday, I was on my own. I thought, well, it'll make good copy, so that's fine. I'm not too bothered about it. But I woke up in this terrible campsite, the worst campsite that I stayed in. I didn't feel that safe there. I thought, you know, fine, it's my birthday. I'm going to go and eat a great croissant. The croissant was terrible. I spilled coffee all over myself. And then I had quite a nice day in Meaux, which is where Brie de Meaux comes from. It's very close to Paris. And I managed to find some nice brie. I went swimming in the river. I drank some cider and got stopped by a policeman for drinking cider in a park. But everything was going well. I met some members of the Brie Brotherhood, who were wearing ceremonial robes, which were just amazing. Great privilege. And then I thought, well, I'm going to leave myself enough time. I've got a Michelin star meal booked for my birthday, the only starred restaurant I went to on the trip. I've been planning this for a while. And it was in a sort of suburb of Paris. And I booked a sort of cheap budget hotel relatively nearby, so I thought I'd give myself enough time. I'm going to have a proper shower first time in, you know, that's not in a campsite where you keep having to push the water every 30 seconds, you know. I maybe paint my nails, big deal. And the road the think Google told me that it would take me, I don't know, an hour and a half to get to this hotel. And I think it took me in the end 4 hours. It was dreadful. It was on the worst roads because it was the main road into Paris or a canal which wasn't paved. And, you know, I was on basically a road bike, so that wasn't ideal. The drivers had become very rude by that point because it was going into Paris. The weather was terrible. I ran out of water. I arrived, I think, 45 minutes. I arrived at the hotel. I got lost. I arrived at the hotel, which was on a massive sort of ring road near an IKEA, 45 minutes after my restaurant reservation. I sort of rang them up, got their answer phone, was crying down the phone, apologising. You know, flung on some different non-cycling clothes, didn't have time for anything, got there, you know, got lost in roadworks on the way, was crying more, arrived there, total mess, you know, honestly, the person you wouldn't let into their restaurant, and the place was full. They were actually turning some people away, and I thought, oh, they've definitely given up my table. And they couldn't, they were so welcoming, they were lovely, they didn't bat an eyelid that I was sitting there with wet hair, creased dress, you know, just looking real, you know, bike oil all over my legs. And they said, don't, you know, what would you like, madame? And I said, yeah, I'd like a glass of champagne and a big bottle of Badoit water. And they appeared as if by magic. I had the nicest meal. I think I must have mentioned it was my birthday, because I think I said when I got the champagne, to justify this extravagance. And they brought me my pudding, which was some little Paris breast and pastries. They put a sparkler in it. Everyone in the restaurant sort of looked slightly bemused. It was so nice. And as I left, I went to pay the bill and I said, I said to madame, you know, thank you for this. You made me so welcome because I was on my own on my birthday. And she came round from behind her little desk, which obviously is a big deal, and gave me a hug and a kiss and said, but you weren't on your own, you were with us. And I honestly started crying again. I was like, oh my word. So that was, you know, it was the worst day, but also it showed me the incredible kindness of people. And yeah, I felt better. I felt better at the end of the birthday than I had at the beginning.
Right. So that was also a low spot and also a high spot.
It was at the very end. Dinner was a high spot, but apart from that, it wasn't a vintage birthday for me.
Right. And how safe were you in cycling around France as a woman, often by yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how safe I was. I felt very safe in general, because I think that actually, I mean, France, you know, is a fairly familiar place, so I sort of felt like I knew the risk, like I would doing the same thing in the UK. But also, I think one of the things that made a difference, that made me feel safer, was that in provincial France, probably as in provincial UK, certainly not where I live in central London, everyone acknowledges each other. You know, if you go into the bakery, you say hello to the queue. If you're brushing your teeth in a campsite, you know, in your pyjamas, people just say, you know, bonjour madame or whatever. And that's nice because you've sort of made contact, and therefore, I don't know, you're predisposed to think of people as friendly. And I did find people very friendly. And so I felt in general fairly safe. There was, as I said, the birthday campsite, I started to think there was only a millimetre of nylon between me and these slightly strange men in this campsite, and I was glad that was my last night under canvas, because I thought, I've sort of had enough of this now. But in general, I didn't feel unsafe. Whether that was naive, I don't know, but nothing bad happened, so.
Right. Okay, so where next?
That is a really big question. I'd love to do either Italy or Spain, but I don't speak any Italian. My Spanish is fairly rubbish. And one of the things that I think, I mean, my French isn't amazing, but it's enough to, you know, talk to people about choucroute and things and to chat to people. So either I need to go on a crash course. I'd love to do the UK, and I think it would be interesting. Maybe I would learn stuff about how, you know, it's easier than I think to find great food in the UK, and I'd love that to be the case, because I love British food. I also have a hankering to do the States, you know, not obviously the whole United States, because it's very large, but I think that would be really interesting. And I met some people when I was cycling who'd said they'd done a lot of cycling in the States, and actually it is, you know, a good, off the main road is a really great place to ride. So I think that would be fun, because I think they can get quite regional, and, yeah, you know, it's not all hamburgers and chains. So that's another idea, but we'll have to see.
Well, I look forward to reading the tweets and then ultimately the book. Right, thanks very much, Felicity.
My pleasure, thank you.
Felicity Cloke's book is called Another Croissant for the Road and was published a week ago. It's a hugely enjoyable book, unusually useful too. Not only does it have the story, but also recipes, including for tartiflette, cassoulet, and naturally for croissants. In addition, you find out where Felicity ate, what she ate, and how it was. So a very valuable companion if you're going to France, whatever your mode of travel. Felicity writes for The Guardian's Feast section, for The New Statesman and for The Wine Society. She knows her food.
Thanks to Felicity Cloak and to Alan Alder, of course. The book sounds really good.
It does.
Here's news of free food available now in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yeah, Olio, as I hope we all know by now, is the free to download on iOS and Android phones and tablets. It's the free app, and using your location, it'll tell you the free food that's nearest to you. So, a quick look at Olio tells us that Dennis has some sel chichon to give away, as well as some Knorr gluten-free beef stock. Now, there's a few days left to collect these. Just write to him to arrange to pick up a time, and Dennis is based on Hills Road, close to the University Botanic Garden. Next up, Sana. Doesn't much like the taste of their Walker's Spiky Sriracha multi-pack. I hope I said that right. And so they have 5 packets to give away. Now, these are veggie-friendly crisps, too. Sana is based on Sedgwick Street, which is on the Romsey side of Mill Road. And finally, Amice, again, I hope I've said your name correctly, has a 230-gram jar of dry quinoa to anyone who's interested, and she's based near Great Shelford. So that's just a few of the things that are currently available right now on the Olio app.
And a reminder that some food outlets sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close, using the Too Good To Miss app.
And time now for some Cambridge ideas for food. Here are resident flavour voices Rosie Sykes and Parker's Tavern's Tristan Welch with some ideas, this time for potatoes. And first, here is Liz Budd with a little bit of background.
Potatoes were first cultivated in Peru and Bolivia. They're part of the nightshade family, as are tomatoes. They're eaten all over the world. By far the biggest producer is China. In Britain, we eat a limited number of varieties, mostly with white or yellow flesh. But some varieties, such as the blue Swede, have blue flesh.
And now here's Rosie Sykes.
Rosie, have you got any good ideas for potatoes?
Well, it is the time for the new season, isn't it, Alan? So we're getting the lovely little ones with the papery skins, which are just gorgeous. And actually, I don't think they need much doing to them, but a few things I like to do. One is obviously a really good potato salad. And my tip with that is boil the potatoes until they're just cooked. Those lovely, just rub off their papery skins and any soil. Try and get them looking really nice, no green. Give them a bit of a scrub, boil them, and then as soon as you drain them, what I suggest you do is put some vinegar on them, whatever you like. I'm really into white balsamic, white Italian vinegar at the moment, because it's got a tiny bit of sweetness, but not syrupy, just a little bit sweet. Put the vinegar on them, and then you can slowly make a dressing to go with them. But that vinegar kind of seeps into them, and it really lifts a potato salad. So I personally, well, there are a lot of different ways I would do a potato salad, but I think a chopped egg dressing is really, really nice. So boil some eggs, use the yolk to make a bit of an emulsion with some mustard and olive oil. Chop up the white with some gherkins and capers, tarragon, parsley, anything along those lines. Really simple, very delicious.
And do you go for any particular type of new potato? I mean, everybody talks about Jersey Royals,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, I'm not a huge expert. I mean, Jersey Royals are wonderful, but I do sometimes wonder if they're worth the sort of £15 a kilo price tag that they have. Because, you know, a well-grown potato is a well-grown potato, really. So I would just go and look and see what you see. I mean, the Cyprus potatoes are really lovely, and the ones from Mallorca as well.
And now here's some advice from Tristan Welch.
Tristan, one of the, I suppose, most common vegetables in Britain anyway is the potato, which a lot of people just boil or turn into chips. Are there any alternatives?
Oh, loads. I mean, it's so versatile. As you may know, here at Parker's Tavern, I'm an absolute addict to extra buttery potatoes. So potatoes with any sort of butter really works well for me. At home, what we tend to do is... Oh, this is great, actually. It's a Scandinavian dish called pitipanna. So it's potatoes that are left cooked from the day before. that you just dice up or roughly chop into sort of centimetre cubes, fry them in a touch of butter or olive oil, and then you put sausage meat or some meat you've got left from a roast from the day before, or some chicken you've got left over, and you throw that in after the potatoes are lightly browned with some carrots, some onions and pepper and any other sort of veggies you've got. But it's all got to be slightly fried, and you serve it with a fried egg and some pickled gherkins. My goodness me, it's absolutely sensational. So pitty panna, that's a great way of using up old cooked potatoes.
Right. Well, some very nice suggestions there. And we're also very pleased to announce that Sam Carter from Restaurant 22 will be joining us for some future editions of this series.
And there's the familiar music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city. Sue?
Well, you can win tickets to this year's Foodie Festival at Parker's Peace, coming up this next weekend. Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern will be cooking up a storm in the Chef's Theatre. And to win, tag Tristan on his Twitter handle with the dish that you'd like to see him make. Another tweet is from Luca at Green Culture HQ, who are opening a bake shop in Ely. And they're having an opening party on the 25th of June, and they're starring Steak and Honour. And finally, sign the petition to save the Flying Pig from redevelopment. There is going to be two public consultation meetings on Thursday the 27th and Saturday the 29th of June. The Thursday meeting is from 5 to 8, and the Saturday is from 10 through till 1. Please go along.
Now, we are all familiar with the Oxford v Cambridge boat race. However, there is a new tradition, and it's hoping to make itself an annual event with the Varsity Oxford v Cambridge Wine Challenge.
So we're here for a blind tasting between Oxford and Cambridge wine companies. Blind tasting is tasting the wine when we have no idea what it is. It's a wonderful practice to get into because it strips all of those sight aspects away from the wine you're tasting, and you've just got to use your sense of smell and taste to work out what the wine is.
And we all know that one glance at the label can make a huge amount of difference because it puts ideas straight into your head.
We're great friends with Oxford Wine Company. This is Ted Sandbach.
Hello, Ted.
Hello.
Hi. Sorry, this is Cambridge 105 Radio. This is the food and drink programme.
Oh, I see. We're on live, are we?
No,
we're not.
Ted is like Oxford's equivalent of Hal, and they've been friends for years.
But when you're confronted with a red or a white completely bare, you've got to actually decide the hemisphere, the country, the grape variety. It is extremely difficult. And even some of the great masters of wine would find it also difficult. And in these days, in the modern world, with wine being made in all sorts of strange places, from China to Brazil, there are many look-alike wines around. So trying to work out the wheat from the chaff is extremely hard work.
The great masters of wine. There's 400 of them on the planet.
390, yeah. It's fewer than the number of people who've been into space.
That's Alice Archer. Now, Alice has been toiling within the great Cambridge wine merchant's machine, but she invited me along to this evening's blind tasting challenge. The master of wine at these proceedings is Martin Gammon, who has selected the wines for this test.
We've been given a new set of wines tonight. I don't know where they're being sourced from.
Not from our ranges. We don't know what these wines are.
Sourced by a master of wine who knows his stuff. So I suggest they probably come from Berry Brothers or Lee and Sandeman or somewhere like that. Possibly Tesco's.
Being globetrotting, he's been picking up a bottle here and a bottle there. So
here he is, addressing the teams.
Okay, now the last bit is very important. There's 1 point for reasoning.
Extra points if you show your workings out. That takes me back to school exams.
I'm only going to give you the 1 point for reasoning if somewhere you've gone wrong, but not badly so.
Yep.
So that means if you get the hemisphere, the country and region, and the grapes right, the reasoning won't apply. You won't get an extra mark for being doubly right, if you see what I mean.
One look at the label, one look at the bottle shape is, you know, worth 50 years of experience. So, you know, you can, I mean, as I say, we've had some disasters, really. You know, I mean, I think yesterday we did a practice and all four people got different answers. So Paul just had to be four people there.
That's pretty normal in our group. I think wine is getting less easy to detect as from a particular hemisphere or a particular country. because there are cooler regions that have been sought out in the supposedly warmer southern hemisphere. You know, it's warming up in the northern hemisphere, and people making wines as ripe as possible. So there's, you know, there's not much difference in alcoholic strength in grape varieties. So the same grape varieties are grown north and south.
The mark for reasoning is, this is a really bad example, but if you said Argentinian Cabernet and it was Chilean Cabernet, and in all other respects you were right, I'll probably give you a mark because I'm nice.
What about price range situation here?
So there's nothing less than 10 quid and there's nothing more than 100 quid. So right, and now I need you all to go downstairs so I can pour your first flight of wines out.
I see.
So what we're looking at is a battle of the Oxford v Cambridge wine merchants. A taste of skill, a taste of fortitude, and one of them will die this night as sacrifice to the wine gods. Okay, the sacrifice isn't true. But, by the way, all of this is taking place at
St John's Chop House on Northampton Street.
And here come the Oxford and Cambridge teams.
If anybody wants anything to drink, ask this gentleman. You can feel the tension, the atmosphere crackling in your headphones, I should think.
The contestants take to their seats for round one. Before each person are six whites, exam papers and a spittoon. Oh, and water to cleanse the palate.
OK, is everybody happy?
Yeah.
Right, we will start. Yes?
Everyone.
Are you happy? This is for fun, OK? Go.
10 minutes, we're starting. Have we started?
Yes, you've started. OK. Thank
you. Everybody goes quiet at this point. Doesn't make for good radio. But this is an exam, so I'm going to explain what's going on whilst playing this lovely cover of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On by Cambridge busker Peter Strakos. And by the way, this is from his CD that I bought when he was playing outside Boots in the city centre.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
What followed was a very intense period of slurping, swirling, spitting, writing, clinking, sniffing, holding wine glasses up to the light, holding wine glasses up to a sheet of white paper, glasses pushed up and down the bridges of noses.
Do bring some love on me today. Oh,
Ted adjusts his glasses and grabs a swig of water. Alice nibbles on her pen top. Then she looks up to see me writing about her nibbling on her pen top. Myself, other journalists and photographers are floating around the seated teams like gangly mosquitoes. One man coughs, another man slurps, an Oxford man puts his head in his hands. Cambridge are busy writing, tasting, swirling, sipping, spitting. So you can see what's going on.
What's going on? What's going on?
Halfway through the exam and everyone's ordered to take a break whilst they set up the red wine challenge. I catch up with a Cambridge contestant at the bar. Would you call this an exam?
It doesn't feel like an exam. It's been too much fun to be an exam. We've been doing our tastings every Sunday night and came up with the idea that when you're right, you feel like a genius. And when you're wrong, it is the exact opposite. It's very good to be humbled in that way. It's good to try a wine that you really like, that somebody kind of reveals and says, actually, this is £5 and I got it at Asda and it's absolutely delicious. We end up liking it a lot. So it's very useful.
How do you get me saying something that's slanderous? It would be even better.
We return to the exam room for the second round.
Okey-dokey. Red, red game.
This time, it's all the reds.
If you head after next door, it's me marking your papers.
You know, I didn't realise it at the beginning, but the air is thick, pungent with the smell of wine. I can taste it through my nose. But I can't name the region, or the label, or the family that made it.
As John says, you ask yourself, what is it not, before you ask yourself what it is. It's tough. It's tougher than it looks. It looks really easy, but it's good fun.
It's 6 p.m. It's raining outside and the traffic is building up. People are desperate to get home. But here in St John's Chop House, it's time to find out the results of the competition.
Only 5 points in the half time. After two rounds, Oxford's score is 214, but Cambridge was 233.
Alice and Cambridge, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're thrilled. It's always good to get one over on Oxford. And then Martin Gammon, who was marking it, he's actually a master of wine, and so he's about as clued up as you can get about wines.
I overheard from somebody else that you are training to be a master of wine.
Yes, it's 7 years, and I've been on the programme for 1 year. Maybe call me again in a decade, and I'll let you know.
Hey, we'll be around, we'll be around. Yeah. That's grand. Okay, well, thank you very much, Alice. It's been a really lovely evening.
Yeah, no, it's been brilliant to have you here, and been good fun having our pals from Oxford over, and having a bit of a friendly battle. We're ever grateful to Joseph Perrier Champagne for sponsoring as well.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Yeah, many thanks to all involved. And you know, it's easy to assume that a wine buff knows everything, but these people were very free to admit that they can be thrown, and they're willing to stake their knowledge and challenge their taste buds to keep their skills in rude health. And it's especially important when they're planning for this to be a regular annual event, the Oxford-Cambridge Blind Wine Tasting.
Laura Donoghue lives in South Cambridgeshire. She's in the shortlist of three for the Guild of Food Writers Food Blog and Social Media category for her blog, Crumbs on the Table. The winners will be announced next Thursday. Laura's putting together a book, a compilation of her essays. She's also working on starting to explore food and identity. I met with her a couple of days ago.
I officially started doing it, about 6 years ago now with the blog, and it's a marvelous vehicle for just self-publishing. So if you have something you want to say, it's a pretty instantaneous way to just suddenly create that, you know, a written body of work and imposing a discipline on yourself to do it. And it's a very, very gratifying way to write and have a kind of conversation with a readership. So I really have loved the blog medium for that. My professional life, many years ago, working as a chef and as a cook, and I really wanted to bring the two together because writing about food is another way of writing about life in a very material and physical and emotional way, and capturing a lot of what's human.
And you worked at Chez Panisse, didn't you, I believe?
I did, yeah. in the 80s, when it was just the most fantastic place to work. And it was a huge influence on me because it was a glorious environment as well. It was full of wood and copper and the most beautiful fruits and vegetables and other sorts of ingredients. And I started off doing things like cleaning 10 pounds of garlic and, you know, bags of squid and trays of sweetbreads and, you know, icky things like that. But we were also surrounded by just beauty and being able to, you know, play with those ingredients. And then I worked up and I did some pastry work, and then I cooked upstairs in the cafe. And just the pace and the buzz and the teamwork, the sense of collegiality in that particular environment was amazing. I'd worked in other kitchens, which were very, very different. You know, dented stainless steel and, you know, it was a sweatshop sort of things. And some that weren't bad at all, but were nothing like Chez Panisse. But the whole philosophy of sourcing beautiful ingredients, paying attention to how they're grown, and respecting the people who grow it as well, really re-educated the American public at the time on how to eat. Because I think that way, you know, there was a lot of distance between what we ate as a culture and how it was grown. And so going back to those sort of back to the land kind of ethics that were, you know, very much part of that movement at the time, you know, it wasn't just a sort of frivolous ideology. It was very, very important, and it's all part of current debates we're having now about sustainability and food security and soil health and all of those environmental questions that are so pressing now.
What is it that you like about being a food writer in the Cambridge area?
Oh gosh, there are so many people doing so many creative things here. Cambridgeshire, we have a real range of, you know, beautiful produce that's grown here. And, you know, grown responsibly by some very caring people as well. We have people who grow heritage varieties of plum and even apricot. I was astonished to discover a few years ago. In Willingham, there's a wonderful place. The Manning family grow, I think it's something like 35 varieties of plum. And they grow the apricots and apples and pears. And some of these are old varieties that you just don't see anymore because they're not very productive. But they still grow them because the biodiversity is very important. And they know that, and they really treasure that, as all of us really should. And the flavor is just exceptional. We have people who are raising organically beef and lamb in this area. There's a wonderful asparagus farm just about a mile away from where I live that grows the most gorgeous asparagus, and it comes in early because some of it is grown undercover, and it's beautiful. And organic growers producing all manner of beautiful things. And I love driving up to Ely and seeing that gorgeous black Finland soil with the different bands of lettuces of all colors and celery and all of the wonderful things that are growing around here, and pick your own strawberries, which, it's not easy to find pick your own anymore, but you can find them up near Ely. And, of course, Cambridge itself with the markets, the hubs with people who are coming in who are interested in sustainable growing, who are interested in eating well, lots of independent places to eat and drink, people brewing their own beers and making gin and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It's really taken off here. When I first moved here about 20 years ago, it wasn't quite as lively in that way. If you looked at the high streets, there were more chain restaurants and things, but now I think there's much more of a culture of independent food retailers and cafes and delis and things where you get nice ingredients, interesting things with a personality on them.
Just probably one last question. With your book ideas, book plans, have you done any submission yet, or is it sort of in the planning stage, or where are you at the moment?
I'm talking to a couple of people at that sort of, would you have a look at my proposal and help guide it, because I know that when I want to make a pitch, I want to really believe in it, and I'm on the right track. So I'm really excited about it, and I feel like it's knitting together. But I've got a little bit of work to do before I see anything between a couple of covers.
And that was Laura Donoghue. Her blog can be found at crumbsonthetable.co.uk. And if you like the sound of Chez Panisse, it's in Berkeley, California, sadly. And interestingly, is also where Jack Van Prague of gelato fame once worked.
And with the warm weather promised over the next few days, plant life will be thriving. So what better time than to talk with Steve Thompson of Grantchester's The Green Man about foraging. And he and Sue went to see what's growing on Grantchester Meadows.
So this is part of, well, in layman's terms, the Daisy family. And this is called pineapple weed. So it's a weed that you'll all know from your driveway. It likes growing in really dry, completely contrary to where we're finding it now. Basically, it likes really dry. It can do really rough soils. It'll come up through your concrete. It's got the yellow buds at the top. It's very closely related to chamomile.
It looks like a chamomile type flower head on it.
Another name to it is wild chamomile.
But, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I find that confusing because there's quite a few. What we're looking for here is the buds. So we take the buds and we can pull them in half. And you'll find a really sweet, nice pineapple-y smell
to it. Oh, wow. It's really fresh pineapple,
it's really
isn't it?
Sharp. Really nice. We do take the buds, and again, we pickle them rather than brining them. So we do it in a slightly sweet pickle. One part sugar, two part vinegar, and three part water. And leave them for a few weeks, and we can put them on loads of different dishes. We basically get a larder built up here that we use them for loads of different specials. And the other thing that we do is we infuse these in our foraging gins.
Yes, I've tried some of your foraging gins. They're rather nice.
They are. They go down well. Not lunchtime drinking.
No, not at all. The flavours are really subtle.
They are, yeah. Some of them, it depends on what we do, but a lot of them we want. So the sweeter smelling things like this, we can make much more pungent. But then other certain things you don't want too much of. You don't want it in your face and offensive. So we play around with it. They're one of a kind batches that we do. things like wild fennel, which is a lot stronger, you really don't want to take over your palate and just completely dull it. We want you to be able to go through the range and try a few, and it stays with you for that drink but doesn't linger forever.
But you don't use the leaves on the pineapple, really, just the buds?
The buds are better. The leaves, there's nothing wrong with using the leaves, but they don't really have the same flavour.
No, not at all. I mean, that is such a strong pineapple aroma. It's just amazing.
And it's a nice, easy one to identify at this time of the year, because anything else that you're going to confuse it with, really, I mean, with these dill-like leaves, it is chamomile.
And you won't necessarily get chamomile growing wild, will you?
So I picked a load the other week, but you get that more on the edge of fields where it's really dry. So if you stop in a lay-by by the edge of a farmer's field, and you've got, what, daisy-like flowers.
That's part of the family, and that is, of course, that's chamomile,
with the same
isn't
sort of
it?
Leaves, yeah. That'll be chamomile. Yeah. I mean, you've got all this pineapple weed in big patches down here, so it's absolutely everywhere. It's a nice one that not too many people use, but it's just starting to come a bit more into fashion, so we'll start to see more and more people picking it. So the next place we'll go, we'll walk through this next field and go up into the woods, which are very overgrown at the moment, but it's lovely.
Is there anything here in this field we could eat? Meadow. Clover.
Got, if you look at the edges, yeah, it's again, it's all the same throughout the meadows. So you've got nettles, clover at this time of year. You've got plantain, but that's much more medicinal rather than edible. It
doesn't have a good taste,
flavor, but it's very good antiseptic, antibacterial. It's anti-inflammatory qualities. If you get a bad cut or anything and you're in the wild, the ribwort plantain, so the thin, long leaf one, chew it up like a poultice, put it on a cut or a burn or cracked skin or anything. It really does work very, very well.
That's the one with the long, sort of slightly brown...
Yeah, with the long stem with the little
stems,
seed top to it.
Yeah. We're walking past some nettles. Can you use them at this stage or they've gone over too much?
You really want nettles when they're younger. But there's a lovely little trick. If you have a patch of nettles and it's grown older, just cut it back. Come back in a week, and the younger ones will start to shoot through, and you can reuse them.
I mean, this is the fascinating thing about foraging, isn't it? From one year to the next, it's always going to be a bit different because seasonality is different.
It is. Everything's different, and every year is different, really. You just have to get out and go walking every day.
Oh, no, that is ground elder.
That's,
I know that.
Is ground elder. This is going on our next menu.
Really?
We've just done a lovely dish with muntjac. If you follow our social media, or mine one personally, which is on Instagram, is Chef Steve Thompson. You check out some of the wild food we do on there. And we've just done a lovely muntjac dish with some ground elder pearl barley. So we take this with a tiny, tiny bit of oil, just enough to bring it together.
So what, you just split it, yes, okay.
Yeah, to get rid of the texture, really.
Okay.
Because it can be a bit, well, it's leafy. But the flavour you get from it is lovely, and it really, really works.
That's actually nice.
You want to add it quite near the end of your cooking if you're going to heat something up with it, because I kind of find it can go a little bit stale tea. Like you get with basil sometimes.
Yep,
if someone's heated up basil to go in pesto or something like that, or to make an oil, it can go a little bit, like an old cup of tea that's been sat on the side.
I know what you mean.
That kind of stale smell to it.
But this is, this is what I consider to be a garden weed.
That's the thing, really. If you want to do sustainable foraging and go and see what's around, you want to be eating the things that are in abundance and in weeds.
Yeah.
So if I take anyone out, I don't want to show them the plants that are less rare and all everywhere and stuff. But we don't want to use them in the pub. You want to use the things that people see as weeds around you all the time.
But again, for any gardener who can't necessarily get out and do the foraging, have a look a bit more carefully. Obviously, don't spray any weed killer on your weeds, because that wouldn't be a good idea to then eat them. But but actually see what you might have anyway that you'd otherwise be digging up.
Yeah, you'll be very surprised. Everything's in your garden already. Well, very few lucky people don't have weeds in their garden. And that, at the moment, is about what's on offer in the meadows at the moment.
Well, I think we'll be coming to ask you in another month or so's time as to what is going to be coming up then.
Yep, excellency.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
Thank you.
And it's all free. Thanks to Steve Thompson there. Do make sure you know what it is you're picking to eat, though. We don't want any of our listeners poisoned.
And there's Green Onion signalling the start of our new section, and we begin with jobs.
There are two jobs available with Jack's Gelato. One is for scooping ice cream at events. You need to be 25 or older and have a clean UK driving licence. Work is mostly at weekends. Shifts are usually 4 to 5 hours, but sometimes 8 or 9. Pay is a very generous £12 per hour.
The second job at Jack's Gelato is for an ice cream chef, full or part-time, temporary or permanent. No evenings or weekends, though. The job is to produce ice cream for the wholesale market. And for both of these positions, you can email jack@jacksgelato.com.
The Burley Arms in Cambridge's Newmarket Road needs a commis chef or chef de partie, 45 to 48 hours per week with 28 days paid holiday. Phone 0744 9393 869 for details.
And if you have a job that you want to advertise in this section, you can contact sales at cambridge105.co.uk. And if you're applying for jobs we feature, please let them know where you heard about it here on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And here's a surprise, Inda's Kitchen is back. Inda's curries are on sale exclusively at Cousins Butchers in Grantchester Street, Newnham. And just around the corner in Eltersley Avenue, Susanna Watson, aka Hum Closen's shop Meadows, is back on Fridays to Sundays.
And between Friday the 28th and Sunday the 30th of June on Parker's Peace, there is a big foodie festival. You can see a range of workshops and masterclasses from MasterChef finalists Delia Maria Assa, as well as appearances from Bake Off winners and top bakers. Tristan Welch will be cooking, including a joint demonstration with Alex Rushmer, and also Daniel Clifford of Midsummer House will be cooking as well. Tickets for the 3 days are £29 for an adult. There's concessions and family and children's tickets available too. So, for each day an adult ticket is £19. Tristan Welch and Alex Rushmer are there on Saturday afternoon. Tristan is by himself on Sunday, and Daniel Clifford is also there on the Sunday. So if you put Foodies Festival into a tax-paying search engine, you'll find all the details, including how to book.
So on the 29th of June from 3 to 6pm, there's a pink-only wine fire organised by Cambridge Wine Merchants. Drinks range from fine champagnes to pale pink rosés. It's at the University Centre, next to the Mill Pub in Granter Place. Meat and cheese boards are in the price, and you pay as you go for samples of drinks. Entry is £10 and it's for over 18s only.
And that's it for today. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1, repeated on Sundays at 2, and podcast early the next week. And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio today is Bookmark, the literary review show hosted by Lee Chambers. At 3:30, it's Off the Page. And then jumping ahead to this evening is Paul Cristoforo at 9 o'clock with Rock of Ages featuring guest Mark Noel Johnson talking about his gigs in the 60s. So that's all from us. We will be back on the 6th of July. And until then,
goodbye.